Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
Before there was a constitution, before there was even a legal system in the United States, communities still had to handle the kinds of disputes and accusations that now wind up in the courts. Many Native American societies devised traditions for resolving discord that took an important reality into account. The parties in conflict would probably remain part of the same community for the rest of their lives. And now a number of U.S. states are realizing that approach might be useful beyond the boundaries of Indian reservations. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rebecca Claren is a journalist with the nonprofit Investigate West. She explains how some tribal courts are providing alternatives to harsh punishments and high incarceration rates among Native Americans, and also a model for state courts seeking better ways to achieve both justice and healing. Her article, Judge Abby Abenanti is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System, appears in the current issue of The Nation. Rebecca, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
You open this piece with the story of a woman named Lisa Hayden, who had been terrorized by her ex-husband. He was abusive. She hadn't gotten much relief from the California state court system. Tell us a little bit about her story.
Yeah, she got together with her partner and eventually husband when she was very young. And when she was pregnant with her first child, he started to beat her. And she would be afraid that he was going to go out and use drugs and try and stop him. And he started to attack her physically, verbally. She did find the will to raise her voice and report him for domestic violence charges. But every time in the state system, he would be arrested on a gang-related charge or on a drug-related charge. And no one ever was addressing the domestic violence issues that were affecting her. And so she wasn't getting any – there was no sort of let's attend to this issue, this partner has. Let's put him in some kind of program that could rehabilitate him in some way. And recently he was getting, last year, in anticipation of him being released from prison, she got really nervous. He'd been sending her very threatening letters from jail, you know, threatening to take her kids, to hurt her. And so she went to sort of proactively get a restraining order to try and protect herself. And the judge just said, you know what? He's been in prison a long time. He gets to see his kids. This is just something you're going to have to work through. And she left just feeling so much despair. And she is a member of the Hoopa tribe. The Hoopa and the Yurok tribes in California have been neighbors forever. She's in some ways has more Yurok ancestry in her than your Hoopa, but she is an enrolled Hoopa tribal member. Her children are Yurok. And her ex-husband is also Yurok. And so she had a Yurok caseworker and a social worker who said, you know, let's see if we can get you some protection and relief from Judge Abby Abenanti. She's a Yurok tribal judge. And so she went to Judge Abenanti, and Judge Abenanti did something that hadn't been done. Not only did she get her a restraining order, Judge Abenanti looks at things in a much broader picture. And so she offered for Hayden's ex to come in and have his gang tattoos removed, to enroll in a program the Yurok have started that rehabilitates people who have beaten their wives or girlfriends or partners and children. And, you know, at this point, her ex has refused all of those services. But they're at least there. There's a container for them in this realm.
So Judge Abby Abenanti on the Yurok Reservation, she's Chief Justice there. She actually thinks it's a benefit if she happens to know the people whose cases she's considering. That's really different from any court that, you know, most of us who are not Native American have experienced, where judges are expected to recuse themselves if they know either party.
That's right. It is really different. I mean, she says it helps her in so many ways. First of all, she knows the family. I was sitting in her courtroom and she said, Who are the old ladies in that family? We got to get them in the mix. Who are the grandparents? Who are the grandmothers who can be involved? There's a recognition that there's systemic issues and systemic solutions. And knowing the families, knowing potentially the history of those families, knowing the resources those families can provide, she thinks that's so helpful to her. She can understand the repercussions of a certain crime also in a way that if you didn't know a family or a community, you wouldn't really understand the depth of the web and ripples of a specific issue that can be caused. And she also just talks about how, you know, she's driving around and she sees someone who has maybe missed their court date. And she says, she pulls her car over and says, "What's going on, you knucklehead? You didn't show up." And they have a conversation and she can help them. And she just feels like it helps her to help others having those relationships.
You know, just last week or the week before on the show, we were talking about empathy, and there's been all this research into the way teachers deal with students who have disciplinary problems, and an empathetic approach tends to work better than one where you just kind of, you know, bring the hammer down on a kid who's misbehaving in class. It sounds very much like Abby Abenanti is doing the same thing with criminal defendants. She's not necessarily, you know, excusing the thing they have done, but she's aware that these people didn't just, you know, come out of a vacuum.
Absolutely. She's one of the most empathetic people I've ever met in my career. And at the same time, she's kind of an awkward, gruff person. She laughs and jokes that she's always trying to raise money for the and apply for grants for the programs she wants to do in her tribe. And she says, "I don't have enough manners to effectively do development work." But at the same time, I came to see that she is constantly worrying about people and constantly problem solving. It just felt like she had this worry shed, not a watershed, a worry shed that she had surrounded herself with. And everyone in her community is in that worry shed. And she is thinking, but I should be clear, she doesn't see her role as just to fix problems for people. She's so clear that traditional Yurok justice meant responsibility, taking personal responsibility for your actions. And so she often says to a family, "Go figure it out. I'll sign off, you know, as long as you can come to some sort of resolution if they're having some sort of parenting dispute, for example. Go in there with the mediator, figure it out. I'll sign off on it. But it's on you." And if people need help figuring out what to do, she helps them. But so does that answer your question?
It does.
Sort of how
it does.
The difference? Yeah. I mean, I heard her talk about this is would it be interesting to hear a specific example of kind of the flexibility and empathetic approach she has?
Yeah.
So the Yurok Reservation hews to the Klamath River, the lower section of the river that spits out into the Pacific Ocean. And the reservation goes for 1 mile on either side of approximately, I think, 50-mile stretch. And the river is the lifeblood of this people. The tribal attorney actually said to me, "Listen, we can't get healthy as a community. We can't solve our more than 70% unemployment rate until our river is healthy." That's my main objective. Is when I clean up this river, when I use the courts to get the, you know, regulations we need to clean up this river and bring the salmon back, we will be healthy as a people. So fishing is a big deal, and fishing violations are a really big deal that Judge Abenanti sees. So she told me this story, and I heard her tell it again another time, of, you know, someone comes in and they've left their net in the river too long. And that's against the rules because they're trying to bring the salmon back. If you leave your net in the river too long, you're going to overfish. And she has someone come in and they say, "Oh, well, and there's a fine. If you leave your net in the river, there's a fine. It's maybe $100 fine." But instead of just saying, "Okay, you left your net in the river, $100 fine, pay it," she might say, "Okay, you left your net in the river. Tell me why." And if the person's like, "Oh, I didn't wake up, my cell phone, I didn't set it." Well, that was kind of a stupid thing to do. So that's on you. But why don't you bring 2 salmon to the next ceremony, or go take 2 salmon to an elder and we'll call it good. Or another person who he said, well, yeah, I left my net in the river, but it's because my auntie, who's really old and stubborn, my cousin was supposed to take her net out of the river, and he couldn't get there. Something was going on with him. So I left my net to run over and take my auntie's net out of the river because I didn't want her to risk getting hurt, taking her net out of the river. And so Abenanti would say, in that case, you did the right thing. That was a responsible thing to do. And next time you see your cousin, hit him for me, you know, or something like that. But just tell him that wasn't very great. So that's an example of the innovation and empathetic response she takes in her court.
So she's looking at intent in some cases because she is freed from the strictures of you know, statutes that operate in state courts.
That's right. She can look at the whole picture in a much, yeah, she has more flexibility. I would say that's accurate.
But she does have a law degree. She was the first Native American woman to pass the bar in California, first Native American woman to become a state judge in California. She is not someone who's unfamiliar with or, you know, in any way in opposition to other kinds of criminal justice and the justice system. She just recognizes that what is needed on the Yurok Reservation is something different.
That's right. I mean, she was, for more than two decades, she was a Supreme Court justice in California. And she tried to quit several times and they kept asking her to come back. You know, when she was an attorney, she was often the first Native American in the courtroom anyone had ever seen in some of those courtrooms. Other attorneys, she told me stories of being spit on by other attorneys a few times. Anyway, that is different than your question. Yes, she says, I don't do peacemaking or restorative justice, some terms that are being thrown around for this, her kind of approach. She says, I do Yurok. But she has, people respect her immensely in her community and beyond because of, I do think because of the work she's doing at Yurok, but also her track record as a state judge as well.
What's her background? How is she able to, you know, navigate so easily in both, both on the reservation and off of it?
I mean, she has been straddling two worlds her whole life. Her mother and her aunties were Yurok. They've both passed, and she would spend time with her extended family on the Yurok Reservation or on Yurok traditional land or nearby. Her dad was a white guy, and his family lived in her grandparents lived in San Francisco, and she would go visit them a lot. And so she had both worlds. She had a grandfather who many people, when she was growing up, compared her to because she was kind of an angry kid, and her grandfather was a bank robber who escaped from San Quentin once. She has this funny thing she said to me of, we're both in the law, just different sides of the law. So that's her background. And I think even though she doesn't talk often about her childhood of growing up with a mother who was drug addicted, and her family really suffered from the effects of colonization. Her mother and her aunt were sent to boarding school, federal and state boarding schools, where they weren't allowed to speak their languages. Or during the time she was growing up, it was illegal to dance, which is a huge sacred act in Yurok religion. And so all of that, her challenging childhood, she was misdiagnosed as being developmentally delayed. That informs her empathetic approach from the bench, certainly.
My guest is Investigate West journalist Rebecca Claren. Her article, Judge Abby Abenanti is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System, appears in the current issue of The Nation. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Investigate West journalist Rebecca Claren. We're talking about the growing influence of tribal courts. Rebecca Claren's article, Judge Abby Abenanti is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System, appears in the current issue of The Nation. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, or you're welcome to call in to 1-800-933-5372. I want to go back to something you said a little while ago, Rebecca, and that is that there's a higher than 70% unemployment rate on the Yurok Reservation. Is that typical of Native American communities around the country?
I am not the right person to ask that. That's not something I have that I feel like I can speak to authority, because I haven't written that article. But there is certainly a lot of poverty on many Native American reservations in this country, and many of the poorest counties in this country are places where there are Native American reservations.
Are Native Americans overrepresented in the U.S. prison system?
That's an article I want to write, but I haven't done it yet. But yes, that is my there are specific jails and prison systems in certain states where they are vastly overrepresented. And there have been some recent reports that show that that Native people just don't get a fair shake in our judicial system at all. There was a recent analysis of data from the Centers for Disease Control that indicated that, and a report from the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. Both of those have come out in the last several years that show that, if you're Native, you are not going to have – you're going to be treated very differently than your white peers.
So Abby Abenanti's sense is that prison is a kind of banishment and should be a last resort punishment. And I gather she doesn't think this because the Yurok are special and this is banishment for them, but this is her feeling about prison and how it affects people.
Yes. I mean, I think she always speaks from a Yurok perspective. She would say that. So for her, as a Yurok person, jail is banishment, and it's the last resort. And you send some, and it should be a last resort. And jail isn't even usually true banishment, because you send someone away for a while, like Hayden's husband, they're going to come back, or ex-husband. And then you haven't really solved any deeper issue. You haven't resolved anything, and you haven't helped the community move forward. So that's why for her, and there's also, and Judge Abby didn't talk about this, but other tribal judges I've spoken to have talked about, listen, like, even if someone has done a terrible deed, if they are removed from the community, that's a loss to the community. They also might at the same time be a son or a wonderful fisherman or, you know, a great teacher, something. And that then is a community loss when you send someone away.
So you mentioned earlier that she encourages aggrieved parties to sort of work together to try to figure out what would atone for something. Does this also work in criminal cases? How does she deal with someone who has committed a crime that hurt someone else? What would the alternative be to a prison sentence?
Well, let's step back. That criminal cases are not – the tribal court can't hear a criminal case. So there's a pretty – wretched history in this country of tribal courts and forums being seen as illegitimate. There's a really seminal court case called Oliphant, and Jerry Gardner, who's the head of Tribal Law and Policy Institute, has given talks to the American Bar Association, calling the Oliphant in the room, that which this court case means that in tribal courts, there's a whole set of laws that basically lay out that many tribal courts can't hear criminal cases, that they can't even adjudicate cases where a non-Native person has committed a crime on tribal land.
Wow.
So against a tribal member. They're very limited. What courts like the Yurok are doing are so inspiring, but they are emerging from incredible financial and judicial restraint.
So talk about what the alternatives are. Let's, you know, when Judge Abbey talks about, you know, prison should be a last resort, what are some of the ideas she has to help people sort of understand that there's a problem and that they can't keep doing this thing, but alternative to prison?
So, I mean, she will say, she'll be the first person to say, some things you can't fix, but that doesn't mean you don't try. Hmm. And it's maybe a years-long process of understanding yourself and understanding the effects you have done and working for reparations. But the tribe has created several programs, and they have so many ideas for more, to sort of wrap services that are culturally specific around people and help them to understand and take responsibility and restore. So, for example, they've created the first tribal program. It's called a Batterer's Intervention Program. And they have men's groups and women's groups, but it's for people who have been arrested for domestic violence charges. And they go through a year-long, I think it's a 52-week program, where they come in once a week for 3 hours and they're in a group. I sat in on one of these meetings, actually, with a group of men who had all been batterers. And these kinds of programs exist in certain states, but this is the first one that also includes Yurok culture. So there's an interview that they have to do with an elder. There's an understanding of the roots of their violence and trying to get at the history of where that comes from in themselves, but maybe also in their family. There's looking at their culture. And like for some people in this program, they've been in jail for so long, their culture is jail. Hmm. But what is the culture that you live in that is contributing to your propensity to batter? And people talk about, I interviewed this guy who had been in jail, and he said, oh, everyone told me the Yurok course was way better than the state one, that it was better. And I was really impressed by the way it was led and again, the compassionate approach that the person leading it took, and at the same time as that compassionate understanding, a real sense of expectation to take responsibility, to be held accountable.
It was interesting to me because it sounds like a real deep dive into, you know, the motivations that cause people to behave in violent ways. And then you write about the fact that, you know, elders have been called in to help with anger management skills. This is something that we call on a special training program for, but who better maybe than someone who has lived in this community for a long time, maybe has learned to overcome their own anger and is now, you know, 70-year-old or whatever, to provide wisdom to younger people struggling.
Sure, and who can even explain the stories maybe of their grandparents prior to being colonized and conquered. And I mean, the massacres that happened to Native people in California were some of the worst in the country. And understanding the roots of some of this violence coming from being placed in boarding schools where kids were beaten if they spoke their native languages or tried to practice their religions, and they weren't parented, so they came back to their communities angry and abused and had no real knowledge how to be parents. And that gets passed on. And really, that history is not very old. The last federal boarding school closed in the 1970s. So we're talking about recent history. And I don't think Abenanti or anyone in the court would say that history excuses current behavior. But there is a hope that if you can understand the roots of your violence, you can start to heal.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have David calling us from Austin. Hello, David.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Sure. I just wanted to mention that, and this was the Yurok tribe, my father was doing his little midlife crisis, and he was driving across the country. And he found himself in an area of a protected forest, I believe, as that's the story went. And some of the Indians there were holding people hostage. They had cut a tree down that fell across the road. And I think they were protesting something to do with trees or logging or forest, you know, destruction. and they took some people hostage. My father was one of those people. And I remember him telling the story because he used her name. It sounded so much like Abernathy. And when he told the story, he said she showed up with a couple of other people. She approached the Indians. They had axes and weapons and things. And then she came over to the people that were being held hostage. She put her hand on my dad's shoulder, and she said everything will be okay. And then she went back and spoke to some of the Indians. And a few minutes later, they let everybody go. And it's a story that I've told multiple times. And I'm driving to work today, and I hear the radio show, and I hear that name. And I just thought I should share that.
Well, thanks so much for your call, David. Wow. Does that sound like an Abby Abernathy story to you, Rebecca?
I mean, sure. It's very possible. I have no idea, but I think that's an amazing story. Thanks for sharing it.
So she goes back and forth. She has a place in San Francisco, and she has a place on or near the Yurok Reservation.
Yeah, she has a place on the reservation, a place, a home that looks out onto the mouth of the river pouring into the ocean. And she does, you know, for years she was still working for the state as a judge, and she was working she only really retired finally from the state a few years ago. So for many years she would be working for the state for a week, and then she would go to the Yurok and work for them for a week, and she would go back and forth. And she has lots of friends and many contacts. She's constantly lecturing and trying to fundraise and things like that. So for her, and, you know, has family and in the San Francisco area. So for her, it's just what's normal for her to go back and forth. But she is 70 years old, and she does a 7-hour drive every other week by herself.
My guest is journalist Rebecca Claren. We're talking about her article in the current issue of The Nation. It's called Judge Abby Abernathy is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Rebecca, you've mentioned she's always fundraising. The kind of work she's doing sounds amazing, and you also write that she's able to give more time, more one-on-one attention to the people who pass through her court on the Yurok Reservation. It also sounds expensive, and she has built a department up from, I guess, just her to, you know, there's 20 people working under her. Where does that money come from?
She has an amazing manager, and they are applying for grants, federal grants and state grants. That's mostly. I think they also seek private donations, but it gets really complicated and probably boring, so I don't want to spare your listeners. But due to a complicated history, the state of California is what is known as a PL-280 state, which, for the purposes of our conversation, it just means they get no allocated funds from the federal government. Unlike the vast majority of other indigenous nations in our country, who the justice system does provide money to their court system, the Yurok and others in California don't get any. And so they can apply for federal grants for specific things. But just in terms of running the show day in and day out, you know, it's not like they're just getting money all the time.
Well, and my point was that the reason that this doesn't exist in every Native American community around the country is that there isn't necessarily money for this. Or if there is, it doesn't cover, you know, anywhere near the full freight.
Well, I'm not sure if that's the reason. I'm sure that's a huge part of it. Tribal courts are incredibly underfunded. Even the tribal courts in the states that do get allocated funds, there was a recent report done under the Obama administration that found that they were only being funded to 6% of the need. When I was first doing research on this, I was told that there's a tribe in Utah that only has enough money for their court to be open once a month, and they run out of money after 6 months.
Wow.
So sure, funding is a huge piece, but you have to remember there's a history of tribal courts and forums being considered illegitimate by the federal government for a long, long time. And so there are certain tribal communities that have never stopped having a good sense of their culture and religion, and having people, whether in the court system or not, that carried that and implemented it in some different kinds of ways. The Navajo have what is called a peacemaking court, and they have code that accompanies the peacemaking process that they do. And there's actually at least 19 different tribal courts that have passed code that explains the peacemaking process. Judge Abinanti, I don't believe she has code exactly that puts into law the process that she goes through. And this is increasing. These peacemaking kinds of traditional forms of justice, which are not sort of a blanket model. People are very clear. Tribal nations have to research and learn from elders. What was the traditional way? What makes sense for us? It's not like here's a boilerplate peacemaking court mm-hmm. that works for Navajo. It's going to work for the Muscogee Nation. But there's trainings being done, and this is now being taught in law schools at Lewis and Clark and Columbia and University of New Mexico. So there is a growing amount of this, but it's still in the face of that more than 100 years of tribal courts being seen as illegitimate forums that are not as good or not taken seriously by the state and federal system.
Yeah, I'm curious about how other jurisdictions, the state and federal or county systems, are beginning to acknowledge that tribal courts have value for the communities they serve and are looking for ways to formally acknowledge the rulings of tribal courts.
So there are now, even though under current law, states are not required to even recognize most tribal court rulings, there are now at least 15 tribal state court forums, which are, you know, they can be anything from that just means that state and tribal court judges get together, or anyone who works in the court gets together and they share information and they talk about cases. But it can also mean that they're actually hearing cases together, that they're sitting on the bench next to each other, and that they're determining what case makes more, you know, when there's a tribal member, should we put this case in the tribal court? Should we go to the state court? They're really working together.
Wow. My guest is journalist Rebecca Claren of Investigate West. She's got an article in the current issue of The Nation called Judge Abby Abinanti is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System. It's about tribal courts. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, send us a tweet to @KERAThink, or call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Rebecca Claren of Investigate West. She has an article in the current issue of The Nation called Judge Abby Abinanti is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System. If you'd like to talk with us about tribal courts and how they work, you can call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about evidence-based results. You noted that the Yuroks haven't done studies of recidivism rates and how they might compare, but some other Native nations that have used tribal courts have, in fact, looked at this.
That's right. So the Cake Tribe in Alaska found that their members, when enrolled in a peacemaking project, fulfilled their court-ordered amends 97.5% of the time,
wow,
compared with a 22% success rate in the Alaska state system. There was another study that I found that there was the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. There was a study that looked at their wellness court, which allows people arrested for driving while intoxicated to receive culturally specific treatment on the reservation. You know, do ceremony, sweat lodges, have an elder be their sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
They had 60% fewer arrests 1 year after entering the program than the DUI offenders, both Native and non-Native, who attended a county rehab program. So those those reports. There's not a lot of studies out there. Those were the limited things I could find, but they're impressive. And they're catching the attention of some county and state judges who are trying to say, can we be inspired by what tribal courts are doing and implement them into our systems?
It is interesting because, you know, the kind of empathy that Abenanti uses in her court is like exactly the sort of thing that judges in state courts are discouraged from expressing, certainly acting on. It might be hard to convert a system as entrenched as the court system, the criminal justice system in the United States.
I think it would be hard. There are certainly, however, people saying we need to change. We have 5% of the world population and nearly 25% of the people in jail. Like, we have a system that is not, this is clearly not working what we're doing. So, yes, I mean, there are people who are looking at the sheer numbers of, as you've said, like, Abenanti spends probably on average 15 minutes with clients and people before her. And that's, I think it's more like 3 minutes in the state system in California that people spend with the judge. It's different. We would have to not have economic incentives to arrest people. We would have to really rethink the system that we currently have. But I mean, that's not to say people aren't actively spending lots of money to try and figure that out right now.
Some critics have worried this approach could be problematic in cases of, say, sexual assault. And I wonder what Judge Abenanti says about the limitations of the way she does things and tries to, find peaceful solutions.
Yeah. Sarah Deer, who is one of the country's, probably the world's foremost experts in Native American and issues of sexual assault, she gets really nervous about sort of, she wasn't specifically super familiar with what Abenanti's doing at Yurok, but just in general, she said, the media loves to talk about this restorative justice model that so many tribal courts are using, but I get really nervous because if you're a victim of some sort of sexual violence and, you know, that this could be, could re-victimize you to have to go into a process where with an abuser. And so Abenanti will say, listen, you know, we can do it. We don't have, she sort of rejected that. She said, you know, we can keep people safe and they don't have to see those abusers. Like, we can do it however we want in a way that always, and I did notice that Abenanti really tries to keep the victims of any kind of crime or assault feeling safe, that felt to me like something foremost in her mind. And I think that's when she was talking about, like, listen, it's not like we just circle up here and go home and we have one sort of session and we're done. Like, this can be a decades-long process and it might not ever work. But it is important for the person who has committed a crime to continue to try and restore and make a change in themselves and dig deep.
Let's assume go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, let's assume that there were a political will to really take the best of tribal courts and use them, apply them elsewhere to try to, you know, bring justice to people, not be unnecessarily punitive. I'm curious about, Rebecca, how you think this would scale, even if everybody thought it were a good idea.
Well, I'm not an expert, so I'm not the right person, but I will say that there's a judge in Michigan. He's been it's Timothy Connors. He's been a state judge for more than 25 years. And he is leading an effort to create county courts in that state that use a tribally inspired peacemaking approach. And it's specific for him in cases where the parties involved will have an ongoing relationship after they leave court. They've been doing this for 4 years. And 94% of the cases resulted in an agreement between both parties and avoided litigation. So here you're seeing that it is working in a specific context, you know, not for every single kind of case, but in certain kinds of things. He's finding that the way he's doing this, and his staff obviously as well, is having really wonderful results. And he talks about that it's not just the goal of these courts It's not just mediation. It's not like just resolve a given issue. But it's rather, how do we deepen an understanding between the affected parties? And he brings, it's not just the two people that are involved. He brings in whoever might be affected or able to offer support. So it might be social workers. It might be family members. It might be other members of the community. And they have what he calls big circles and little circles. He literally steps down from his bench. They circle the chairs in the courtroom. They sometimes say, we need a smaller circle. Hmm. And so it's just the two affected parties, and they'll leave and go with maybe the judge, maybe another person who's received extensive training on how to do this work. And then they'll come back and be a part of the bigger circle. It definitely takes a lot of time. This can take hours. But he feels, you know, he says it's the idea of cleansing and healing versus judging. These courts are designed not to get even, but to get well. And so this is happening in the county where Ann Arbor, Michigan is, but they're starting to expand it throughout Michigan.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Patty is calling from San Antonio. Hello, Patty.
Hello, how are y'all?
Very well, thanks.
I am Native American. I'm Cherokee. And this court thing, I was wondering, do we have tribal courts here in San Antonio, and do they just listen to their people, or do they listen to all the Native American issues who are kind of separated from their own group?
So I don't know, but if you want, after we get off this call, I could help connect you to some resources to help you figure that question out, because I didn't specifically look at Cherokee. What I do know is that some tribal courts are only dealing with the land and their tribal members. However, Cherokee is a really different issue, right? Oklahoma is different. The land is a different way. So I'm not really sure. And I do know that there was a law that was passed at some point in the last several, 50 years, that said, the federal government said that tribal courts can actually adjudicate cases between different tribal members. They don't have to all be members of the tribe where the tribal court is based. So I'm not sure, but I can help you find that information.
All right. We will we'll keep Patty on the line and get her email address and see if we can connect you to that way. One thing I was wondering, Judge Abby Abenanti seems like such an extraordinary individual that I was wondering if you can duplicate sort of the wisdom that she has brought to this. Is it possible to create a system that enables other people to act with the same really good judgment that she has used with the Yurok people?
I think that's the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. So she's a charismatic leader. She's incredibly well-respected within her community and beyond her community. She has, because of her experience as a state court judge, I think she's able to do things, get funding, get the clout to implement certain programs that another individual might not. So I don't know. But there is an increasing number of really incredible Native American attorneys in our country, and there's more and more all the time. So I asked that question to Abenanti at one point, and she sort of poo-pooed me, of course, and said, sure, I think about what happens after I die, but I don't really worry about it. I have really amazing people. I'm inspired by the young people I see working in this community and beyond, who are tribal attorneys and leaders.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm curious, Rebecca, because clearly you really liked her. What was she like to interview? If she's someone who says she doesn't have the manners necessarily to make nice with fundraisers, that sort of thing, was she eager to speak with you? Did it take some convincing?
I mean, I'm laughing because it was so awkward at first. I met her in this cafe. I flew into San Francisco. I live in Oregon. I flew into San Francisco, and we were preparing to drive 6.5-7 hours to the Northern California, the Yurok Reservation. And I did that because I left it the chance to have the time to speak with her. But we sat down at the cafe before we were getting on the road. And I mean, it was so awkward, this awkward. We could hardly get past hello. And I'm a card carrying extrovert. And I felt like I had I didn't know what to say. And she didn't know what to say. I literally went into the bathroom and looked in the mirror and said a swear word, like, oh, God. But she is so warm. I mean, she's a little bit gruff and a little bit awkward. And then she's like, in some ways, becomes the easiest person you've ever met to talk to. And we were in the car, and she's very, very honest and very fearless. I mean, I've been a reporter for almost 20 years, and I think it's reasonable that people, when encountered with a reporter, tend to be nervous about how they will be portrayed. And she didn't care about that at all. You know, she didn't care about that. She hasn't even read this article. She told me, she was like, people have told me it's the best, but I spend enough time with myself. I don't need to read about myself. So she actually, the Yurok, they are a storytelling people. They have always been storytellers, and they have a cultural belief, or maybe it's a religious belief, that the way things change is by telling stories. And so as a people, I was welcomed. People were open with me. People talked to me. I was given incredible access. So despite that really awkward introduction, no, I had a very, I was very welcomed, and people spoke with me at length.
Well, you've been on the show before, and last time we talked about education, and I'm curious about, you know, taking on a beat like issues of importance to Indigenous Americans. There are so many cultures to learn. On the one hand, how exciting. On the other hand, what a challenge to accurately represent the people that you're writing about and where they come from culturally.
Yeah, it's hard. And I worry all the time that I'm doing a bad job. And Investigate West has created an advisory board of Native American journalists and thinkers to help us do these stories better. I have a lot of ambition of ways we might increase the specter of Native journalists in this country that I can't say more about right now. But yeah, I feel really honored to do this work. And it is a challenge, but it's so interesting, and I'm glad to be expanding at least just a little the coverage of Native Americans, who I would say for the most part are very forgotten in this country.
I mean, how much of it is about showing up and saying, I legitimately want to learn, and I want you, the individual from this culture, to explain it to me?
Sure. It's about listening, as it always should be. And I think that is the key. I have something that I wrote down that I asked Judge Abby when we were in the car early on in our drive, actually. I said, do you think I should be doing this work? I'm not a Native person. I said, should I be doing this? And she said, sure, it's fine. And she said to me, and I've written this down, it's actually now on a note card above my desk. She said, you're going to make a mistake every day. It's the biggest mistake to think you won't make mistakes, because then you don't learn from them.
Rebecca Claren is a journalist with the nonprofit Investigate West. Her article, Judge Abby Abenanti is Fighting for Her Tribe and for a Better Justice System, appears in the current issue of The Nation. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast and archives of old shows at think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.